Almost 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion coming up.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
Welcome back to Extinction Rebellion Radio. This is Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is a nonviolent movement with the overall ambition of an international rebellion that helps humanity to turn quickly onto a course compatible with life on Earth. We operate with a decentralized structure.
Carbon dioxide levels are the highest they've been in 3.6 million years. That's according to a new report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. According to the NOAA, the average amount of carbon dioxide, that is CO2, in the atmosphere was 412.5 parts per million in 2020, an increase of 2.6 parts per million through the course of the year. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas that is contributing to global heating. Now, the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego released similar results this past Wednesday, announcing that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 417.4 parts per million at their monitoring station in Hawaii. The increasing trend exemplifies a vicious cycle of global heating, says the NOAA. 13 years ago, in the year 2008, we saw the emergence of 350.org, a climate action organization founded by Bill McKibben and his cohorts. Now, Bill McKibben is a world-renowned author. He's an environmentalist and he's an activist. And in 1988, he wrote The End of Nature, the first book for a common audience about global warming. Anyway, according to 350.org's website, quote, 350 was named after 350 parts per million, the safe concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, end quote. Or as the Center for Biological Diversity put it back in 2009, the scientific consensus is clear. We must reduce the level of atmospheric carbon dioxide, or CO2, to 350 parts per million or below to stabilize climate change and avoid global catastrophe.
An American team led by James Hansen at NASA and his colleagues, really our foremost climatologists, published a paper in January of 2008 that gave us a number. And that number, and it's the most important number on the planet that we never knew it till 18 months ago, was 350 parts per million CO2. Any number greater than that, they said, in the abstract of a peer-reviewed scientific paper, was not compatible with the planet upon which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. Strong language and a very strong number, especially strong when you consider that we're already past it.
So we've blown past 350 parts per million. We are on the path of what the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change calls the worst case climate scenario. That is RCP, or Representative Concentration Pathway 8.5. SciTech Daily reports that researchers have for the first time confirmed that, quote, Pine Island Glacier in West Antarctica could cross tipping points, leading to a rapid and irreversible retreat, which would have significant consequences for global sea level. Pine Island Glacier is a region of fast flowing ice draining an area of West Antarctica, approximately two-thirds the size of the United Kingdom. The glacier is a particular concern as it is losing more ice than any other glacier in Antarctica, and it is contributing to increase in global sea levels. 417 parts per million and counting.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may fall.
That was Zager and Evans singing In the Year 2525. You know, we wasted 4 good years suffering an administration that was dead set on unleashing the fossil fuel industry and exacerbating our climate crisis. Among other things, Donald Trump signed memorandums to revive the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. He issued a sweeping executive order directing all federal agencies to target for elimination any rules that restrict U.S. production of energy. And he lifted an Obama moratorium on new coal leases on federal land. That's just the tip of the melting iceberg, right? Of course, intertwined as they were with Trump's broader white nationalist and fascist agenda, Donald Trump's orders were in truth the makings of a white nationalist and fascist climate policy. He made explicit, in fact, just how much extraction is part of the ongoing project of colonialism. Our climate crisis is part of the ongoing project of colonialism. This past week, the Biden administration released its Made in America tax plan, and it is touting the fact that the tax plan will provide $35 billion in savings over the coming decade through the elimination of subsidies to fossil fuel corporations. Now, that's a beautiful thing. You know, let's remove those subsidies. But as Greenpeace USA senior climate campaigner John Noel tells us, Made in America is simply not good enough. And why is that the case? Well, because a recent study cited in the plan itself reveals that fossil fuel corporations will rake in around $62 billion per year in the United States through both direct and implicit subsidies. So over the next decade, we will continue to support with our tax dollars the fossil fuel industry. And let us not forget, President Biden is all in for fracking. Are we on the cusp of another wasted 4 years? You know, no amount of green or environmental justice speak can change the fact that fracking and subsidies for fossil fuel industries are at bottom extinction policies. They are not life policies because they are not policies that contend with the reality of 417 parts per million. They are extinction policies. 417.4 parts per million and climbing will not bend to real politic. Neither should we. On the afternoon of Friday, April 2nd, Extinction Rebellion New York City took part in a protest in Manhattan in which the group, in alliance with other climate groups and in solidarity with Minnesota's indigenous water defenders, visited the Midtown headquarters of the big banks most responsible for funding fossil fuel projects, and the Line 3 tar sands pipeline in particular. The purpose of the action was to express our opposition to their policies. At the Madison Avenue headquarters of Chase Bank, the worst funder of fossil fuel projects in the financial industry, an Extinction Rebellion protester, Kevin Clark, who was attempting to climb onto an awning on the 46th Street side of the building, slipped and fell, sustaining serious injury. Emergency medical technicians were called to the scene. He was taken by ambulance to a hospital where he was temporarily held by police. Clark was not allowed for a time to make phone calls to family members. Clark's injuries were not life-threatening, and he is expected to recover. It's not our intention to praise what Clark did, much less hold him up as some kind of role model. However, it should be noted that the severity of the climate emergency is driving activists to take greater and greater risks to try to bring the emergency to public attention. That context must be kept in mind when evaluating stories such as this. It should also be noted that the mainstream media's coverage of the event, after several videos of Clark's fall were widely distributed, has been predictably utterly inadequate. Friday's event was misidentified by the few outlets that covered the story of the injured protester as an anti-capitalist protest rather than a climate justice action. One website said an anti-capitalist protester was trying to make some sort of statement when things went terribly wrong. Another said the protest was kind of a scaled down version of Occupy Wall Street, but with way fewer people and no real organization. Clark kind of derailed the whole thing. Later, a story was published by the New York Post online that clarified things somewhat, though not clearly enough. Kevin's sister, who was interviewed, specifically denied that it was an anti-capitalist protest, but the headline and photo caption still explicitly identified Kevin as an anti-capitalist protester. Extinction Rebellion was finally mentioned, as well as the fact that Chase is the worst bank as far as funding fossil fuel projects are concerned. But the tone was still snide and derogatory. story, such as describing Kevin as an ersatz Spider-Man. And the Post gleefully pointed out that the allegedly anti-capitalist Clark was also a small business owner, nonsensically implying hypocrisy on Kevin's part. Also, in none of these stories were the words line three or even pipeline mentioned. In fact, there was little to aid the reader in making sense of what happened. Not exactly, you know, a proud day for American journalism. There's a GoFundMe page to help Clark during this difficult time, as he had experienced financial difficulties even prior to the accident, owing to the COVID pandemic. We will publish on our website the URL for this GoFundMe page for anyone interested in donating. As of now, the GoFundMe page has reached about $21,000, $4,000 shy of its $25,000 goal. And as for the coverage by the mainstream press, Extinction Rebellion will continue to protest and it will demand real coverage of our climate emergency, which includes honest reporting of the banks that are banking on the very industries driving us to and beyond 417.4 parts per million. You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane, and we're here talking about climate crisis news.
The way to solve the climate crisis is to stop emitting greenhouse gases. We don't have the technology at scale yet to take those gases out of the atmosphere. We have to stop putting them in. The only known solution to the climate crisis is to stop emitting greenhouse gases. The longer we take to do that, the worse it's all going to be. It's going to be pretty bad already. We're going to lose Florida and coastal areas all around the world, probably Amsterdam and New York. Dubai will be uninhabitable at a temperature at which humans cannot survive. Bangladesh is going to flood, and it's going to cause the largest migration in human history. That's already probably locked in, but it can get a lot worse from here. The thing is, it doesn't have to if we act boldly and quickly. We could do like 10 shows on how bad it could get, and we probably should. For an overview, the book The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells does a good job summarizing it all. Suppose everybody reads Wells, and suppose everybody listens to the show, and we really did muster the big scale international buy-in for a fast transition from greenhouse gases to zero emission sources. Then what? As in, how would we do that as a global society? How do we stop fossil fuel emissions? Even if we have the will to do so, how do we stop fossil fuel emissions when so much of the technology that's basic to modern life burns fossil fuels? I am really into this question right now. It's going to take a few shows to work out all the elements, but I totally want to do it. I want to imagine in detail what would happen, what would it take, what would it look like, what would be involved. So first, we should remember something. If we shut down all carbon-emitting technology tomorrow, no more cars or airplanes, no more industrial production, no more digital servers, our lives, of course, would very dramatically change. But we wouldn't lose our lives. We won't die. Humans would not go extinct if we stopped emitting carbon. The vast majority of human history took place without these things. Prioritize hospitals is what we would do for the scarce electricity from existing solar and wind sources. And if we prioritize hospitals, no one would actually die from the end of fossil fuel emissions. What's at stake is our lifestyle rather than lives as such. In fact, a huge number of people are going to die from global heating. So the threat to human life is not from cutting off greenhouse gas use. The threat to human life is from not cutting off greenhouse gas use, more so than from cutting off greenhouse gas use. I don't mind saying that one again. If this show ever becomes really well known, the conservative media are going to come after us and they'll hammer us for that one. Somebody's going to write editorials against it. And you know what? I am proud to own it. Here it is, conservative media. The greater threat to human life is from not cutting off greenhouse gases more than from cutting off greenhouse gases. Okay, so how do we do that? How do we stop using the fossil fuels that make greenhouse gases? In my view, we can't possibly do it without government regulation and enforcement. 7 billion people on Earth. You're not going to persuade all of them to do all this by themselves of their own accord. Of course, it's less than everyone on Earth who would have to be persuaded. Huge segments of humanity live in so much poverty, they emit very little carbon. I've read that the average emission per person in Niger is 0.1 tons of carbon per year. In the United States, it's 16.4 tons per person per year. 0.1 tons per person in Niger, 16.4 tons per person in the United States. That's 164 times more carbon emission in the United States per person. So naturally, we should focus our efforts on the industrializing countries. Still, how many people live in industrialized or industrializing countries? It's more than a couple billion. And they all have access in some form to oil and gas. And some of them won't stop using it unless there's collective effort to deny it to them. And that only happens with powerful institutions who have enforcement capacity. And that means governments. This isn't trivial, what I'm saying. I'm saying we're not getting there with voluntary measures. We might as well stop talking about voluntary measures and start talking about very bold government regulation and enforcement. Okay, what does that look like? What would things be like in such a situation? As far as I know, very little has actually been written about this in terms of serious policy design. There is one short piece that I've seen that tries to start talking about this. It's just 4 pages long. It's in a book called This Is Not a Drill, an Extinction Rebellion Handbook, published in 2019 by our organization. And it's written by Hazel Healy. We talked about this book on the very first episode of the show, but not this particular chapter. Healy starts by pointing out that no government seems to be doing anything remotely close to what is required and suggests, quote, perhaps a more vertiginous transition would help focus the minds of world leaders. What if we aimed to cut absolute carbon emissions to zero by 2025? No one knows if it's possible, let alone at this rate, but it's instructive to imagine how such a scenario would play out. Unquote. I'm reading this and I'm coming to the edge of my seat. Yes, it's instructive. Let's consider it. Let's consider what it would mean, absolute zero emissions in 5 years. Healy arrives at 2 key paragraphs. I'll read them. Quote, in the rich world in particular, zero carbon would usher in a period of huge social change. Energy would be stringently rationed, dedicated to survival and essential activities. We'd go to bed early and rise with the sun. Expect massive disruption in the way food is grown, processed, and distributed. More turnips and fewer mangoes on the menu in the UK, for starters. Globally, there would be much reduced private car use, virtually no aviation, hauling, or shipping, spelling a dramatic end to material globalization as we know it. But energy lockdown wouldn't last forever. Leading energy and climate scientist Kevin Anderson suggests that after a few turbulent decades, by 2040, renewables may be generating up to 50% of present-day energy use. Reforestation and habitat restoration will steadily suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Regenerative economies powered by sunlight, as Oxford University-based researcher Kate Raworth puts it, will improve well-being for everyone. Society will be more localized, healthy, and familiar. Unquote. So Healy is saying that a permanent cutoff in greenhouse gas emissions would cause a temporary reduction in energy supply and transportation capacity. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about absolute zero carbon, a temporary reduction in energy supply and transportation capacity. The reduction at first would be severe, and that would transform our lives. But it would get less severe over time, and we could gradually resume the electricity-hungry technologies and routines of our current daily lives. It would take years. We're not sure how many, but surely more than one or two. It would not be an easy way out. As far as we know, there is no easy way out. But it would be a way out. I'd like to build on what Healy says, and Anderson, the researcher she cites. In the fantasy world where this happens, the technological return would probably happen faster than she thinks, maybe a lot faster than she thinks. If we really did cut off greenhouse gas use, the incentive to produce zero emission technology at scale would skyrocket, and so would production. The electric car factories would run night and day, powered by wind turbines and solar panels, of course, maybe nuclear power. The efficiency of batteries would go way up way fast because all the engineers would turn their attention to building more efficient batteries. The profit margins would be huge for getting that done. Massive incentives to get it done and to get it done very quickly. Now, we don't have to wait around for new inventions, although there might be some new inventions that would help the situation even more. And if that happens, it's going to shorten the time span even more. But we don't actually need them strictly. We've had zero emission power sources for years. We've had zero emission cars for years. We have zero emission planes now, in prototype form. I'm aware that going from prototype to large-scale production is not easy, but guess what? If we shut down global air travel, it will suddenly be incredibly profitable, and they will figure out how to solve that problem real fast. It's not precisely predictable, of course, but we might be looking at a somewhat short time period of transition in the optimistic scenario. The trigger is a real shutdown of greenhouse gas use. If world governments do that, it will both transform our existence into low technology living and unleash very rapid acceleration toward the return of our high technology living. I have a huge amount of respect for Healy for having the courage to say this. Yes, we will have to temporarily live without much of modern technology, and that means living in a fundamentally different way. All the other options we know involve planetary catastrophe. All the other options that we know of involve planetary catastrophe. If anybody's got another one, another option, and it's backed by real information and rigorous analysis, let us know. We are all ears. But unless somebody's figured out something else and isn't telling, then here's the deal. We either live with severely rationed power temporarily, or we have planetary catastrophe. I must keep emphasizing that the rationing of power would be temporary, not lifetimes, and I suspect not even decades, more like years. Would you do it if it meant the stability of human life and animal life on planet Earth? Would you do it if it meant the long-term preservation of modern society? Unfortunately, the question isn't directed at you, the individual listener. It's directed at humanity as a whole, perhaps particularly those who have state power and could, in real life, make the choice to cut off fossil fuels. How do we induce humanity as a whole to choose rationally and undergo this transition to sustainability? That is what Extinction Rebellion is trying to accomplish. You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI, hosted by Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. This week, we are talking about some recent news items. We are talking about what it would really take to transition completely to a zero emission future. And we have a good news segment coming your way as well, where we're talking about making roadways out of plastic. Now for our segment on good news, researched by Nancy Pendergast. Sources of information are the Yale School of Environment's online magazine and The Guardian. Plastic companies love recycling programs because it lets us all off the hook for using a product that is harmful to the planet. In reality, most plastic is not recycled. Some estimates only 10% of plastic is recycled. One innovation to address that problem comes from India. Rajagopalan Vasudevan, a chemistry professor, realized that molten or melted plastic is an excellent binder. He noticed similarities to bitumen. Bitumen is the tarry, gooey, smelly substance that's used to hold together the gravel or sand in a road. Bitumen releases toxins into the air when it is heated. It reduces greenhouse gases into the air when it is heated. Now, plastic, if it's in liquid form, does not. When you make a road with recycled plastic as a binder, the road tends to be more durable, flexible, and less prone to potholes, and also tends to use less carbon to construct. The first road that Professor Vasudevan made on his college campus in 2002 is intact and working today. India now has over 60,000 miles of plastic-binded roads. And of course, the question is, should we be doing this elsewhere? For years, fishers on the Kollam coast in India threw the plastic garbage they caught in their nets back into the ocean. Now they save that plastic instead of throwing it back into the ocean. And they save it primarily to care for the sea and the fish that provide their sustenance. Sorting and cleaning the plastic from the ocean provides jobs for many women in a traditionally male-dominated workforce. The roads built with the plastic they save have proven to hold up better than traditional roads under India's extreme heat. And of course, it's getting hotter all the time. Meanwhile, Australia too has paved hundreds of miles of plastic roads, mostly smaller local ones because local governments are more willing to opt for the sustainable option. But there's no technological barrier to making large roads with plastic binding. Caltrans, the California Department of Transportation, tried last year to pave Highway 162 using liquefied plastic, but they were not satisfied with the result. Undeterred, they are planning another attempt with a different construction method soon. It is true, we do not yet know how these roads will hold up decades from now, but they are answering a problem of tremendous waste and helping to lower emissions. For every ton of bitumen left out of a road, as much as one ton of carbon emissions is saved. So let's give some thought to making plastic-binded robes. This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio. Thank you for listening and join us next week every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding a meeting on Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. It's a remote access meeting accessible to the public, including an opportunity for public comment. The LSB meeting is Wednesday, April 14th at 7 p.m. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099, 929-205-6099, and enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995, 922-457-2995. And if that wasn't enough numbers, we also have a password. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, 995. So it's 995-995-99. Again, the phone number to call is 929-205-6099. The meeting ID is 922-457-2995. And the password is easy to remember because it's 995-995-99. Instructions for signing on to the meeting, including a link for listening over the web, is available through WBAI's main webpage, WBAI.org. Thanks for listening to all these numbers, and we hope you join us at the LSB meeting, April 14th at 7 p.m.
Hello, New York City. My name's Hannah Cousins, otherwise known as DJ Bangs, and I'm a student DJ at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm normally heard exclusively on our campus radio station, WXYC Chapel Hill, 89.3 FM. We broadcast to the Chapel Hill, Durham area of North Carolina. But this Friday night, some friends and I are graduating from our radio station to yours. That's right, it's a Tar Heel takeover, and we're taking control of the Harlem Connection on WBAI. Think of it as the Harlem Connection with some North Carolina flavor to it. So join us for the journey this Friday night at 10 right here on WBAI 99.5 FM and on WBAI.org.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get very many opportunities to speak out in regards to the wrong that was done to my son and the other boys in the Central Park jogger case, as it was called at that time. Very few people stepped up. Yes, Like It Is was there. WBAI was there. And a few others. Majority of those stations that let people like myself speak and tell them what was going on the other side, those stations are gone. If we lose WBAI, where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI.
No justice.
This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.